Welcome, Hugh. It's great to have you with us today.
Thank you, Elaine. It's great to be talking to you.
Well, you've written so many titles about Titanic. Where and how did your personal fascination with the ship and the story begin?
Well, I think it began when I was about 12, when I saw A Night to Remember on television. And I remember my brother saying to me, "What would you do? What would you do if you were on the Titanic?" And I think that's something Walter Lohr did so brilliantly with his book and the film based on it, was make us all feel we were there. And what would we do if, you know, we were on this sinking ship? And I think that is part of the reason for the fascination of the Titanic. Of course, later I would meet Walter Lohr and some of the survivors of the Titanic when I worked with Robert Ballard, the man who discovered the Titanic, on his book. And I asked Walter to write an introduction for that book and for several other books that I did as an editor and publisher as well. So that's where it really all started. And then when I was, you know, in my early 30s, working as an editor for a small publishing company, we had this amazing coup where Robert Ballard found the ship. And before he did, we'd met with him and said, "Look, if you find this ship, we would really love to do your book." And so I spent 2 years working with him on his book, The Discovery of the Titanic, which became an international bestseller. And I thought, when that was all done, that I was done with the Titanic. But then publishers just wanted more books about the Titanic, because they discovered the Titanic really interests people. So we did a lot of books about the Titanic.
And what's the process you use to uncover new facts about a historical event like Titanic? How long is the research period, and how do you really get started with the writing?
Well, the research period, I guess, has been about 25 years because I started working on the Titanic in about 1985 when I started working with Ballard. And I've just never been able to get away from the story, but it's ongoing, including this morning. You know, I continue to do research. I thought I had the research done for this book, but all the time there are new things being uncovered about the passengers, which is what my new book is about, and new things that I need to research all the time.
Well, of the famous people, the glitterati who were on the ship, Benjamin Guggenheim, John Jacob Astor, who, in your opinion, acted the most gallantly, and then who acted the most cowardly?
Well, I actually think that it wasn't the glitterati who behaved the most gallantly. I really think, you know, the crewmen, the engineers who kept the lights going, you know, the bakers who brought up bread from down below on deck to give to people in lifeboats. You know, Thomas Andrews, the ship's builder, who knew it was going to sink and made no effort to save himself, but made sure that women in particular and children got into lifeboats. To me, those are the real heroes of the story.
Is there any new information on the sinking, something that's been discovered most recently?
Well, that's not what I'm writing about. I'm writing about the passengers, and there's lots that's new, new research about passengers. I'm not sure there's much more to be told about the actual sinking or how it sank. There are new theories all the time on everything from the fact that the steel was too brittle to just recently the granddaughter of Second Officer Lightoller, who was the senior surviving officer, made some headlines to promote a novel that she's just written, in which she said that her grandfather told her grandmother that the man at the wheel actually steered the ship into the iceberg. You know? So a lot of these new theories about the ship, I think, are bogus, and I have no interest in that. What interests me is this remarkable cast of characters, this, you know, incredible slice of the Gilded Age that is so beautifully represented on the Titanic as a microcosm of its era.
When the passengers realized that the ship would indeed sink, did any of them leave notes or letters that were subsequently discovered?
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting question, Elaine, because, again, most of the so-called notes that were left were fairly bogus. I mean, There was a famous note that has made its way into Walter Lord's books and a number of others from one of the gamblers who was on board, supposedly. There were three professional gamblers, card sharps on board, who were playing cards in the smoking room and fleecing passengers. And one of them was supposedly this gambler named J.H. Rogers. And there is a note that said, if saved, contact my wife and so forth. And then at the end it says lost J.H. Rogers. And this was believed for years until somebody, a researcher whom I know, tracked it all down and found out that Rogers was never on the Titanic. He was a crook who the police were looking for, and he persuaded a woman to give this note to a newspaper office after the Titanic sank, so that he could pretend he died on the Titanic and get the police off his trail.
That's pretty ingenious.
Yeah, so that's pretty clever. There was also a note found in a bottle off Ireland from one of the Irish passengers. But again, nobody knows if that's genuine or not. The Titanic, it took about 2.5 hours to sink. Most people were either complacent, thinking the ship wasn't going to sink, or they were busily getting into lifeboats. They weren't really writing notes.
In your new book, you write about Brooke Astor, the daughter-in-law of John Jacob Astor, and how the circumstances of her recent death became the last Astor scandal. Can you give us a sneak peek about that story?
Well, that's a pretty well-known story. To be honest, I haven't written it yet because that's the last chapter.
Oh.
But to me, it is interesting how these stories go on, and the Titanic, the last survivor, for instance, just died last year. She was a baby, of course, didn't remember much, but and then just I think the year before that, big newspaper story about Brooke Astor's son being convicted of defrauding her estate, her $200 million estate of money, and he was tried and convicted for that. And I thought, isn't it amazing that the daughter-in-law of a man who was on the Titanic, only just died. So the story has resonance and has impact to this very day, which is what fascinates me.
With all your historical research, what actually do you think about the, were there inconsistencies and errors in the Cameron's film, or was it pretty straight on?
Well, I'm a fan of the Cameron movie. I don't like to slag it because, I worked with James Cameron. In fact, his film was partially inspired by a book that I worked on called Titanic and Illustrated History, which had these marvelous paintings by a guy named Ken Marshall, who's the ultimate Titanic artist, and Don Lynch was the historical advisor. And they both, Cameron loved the book, and so did us a lot of good. And I would say that the look of the Titanic and the events of the sinking are as accurate as you will ever get in any Titanic movie. But of course, the story, being for a movie, is fictionalized and is a little fanciful. And third-class boys didn't have affairs with girls in first class and so forth. That's all a little bit fanciful. And the famous scene, of course, where they embrace, at the very bow of the Titanic. Well, that's the forecastle deck of the ship, or the forecastle deck, as it was known. And passengers weren't allowed there. So the chances of the two of them embracing at the prow of the Titanic is a little bit fanciful. But yet it's a highly gripping film. And without that love story, how popular would it have been? We don't know. But certainly the way the Titanic looks on that film and the efforts that Cameron went to make the film look accurate are absolutely extraordinary.
Well,
It's coming out again in 3D for the anniversary in 2012. So that'll be something to see.
right. Well, Hugh, you've written both fiction and nonfiction. Do you personally prefer one over the other?
Well, I've only recently written nonfiction for young readers. I always thought I was I'm sorry, fiction. I always thought I was a nonfiction guy. And Scholastic, who are a big children's publisher, said, "Would you write a novel for us?" And they had an idea. And I said, "I'll have to think about that. I've never done that." But I actually found it liberating to write fiction because I could use dialogue, for instance, and I could get into the heads of historical characters. And to me, writing fiction was more real in a way than writing nonfiction, and quite liberating. So I like doing both. I mean, this book, Gilded Lives, Fatal Voyage, that HarperCollins is publishing in 2012, for the anniversary is nonfiction. Yet I've done a novel called that I've just completed. It's not out yet either, called Fatal Voyage for Scholastic. And it's a novel for kids. And I think it's as every bit as real as the nonfiction book, because being a nonfiction kind of guy, I can't make things up. You know, I can't fictionalize too much. I have to make it accurate.
Well, what's your next project after you finish the two Titanic efforts that you're doing?
I'm not absolutely certain. I've written a book in the past about the last Tsar of Russia's family, about Anastasia, his famous daughter, which was nonfiction. And the last Grand Duchess of Russia, the last princess, sister of the Tsar, actually died here in Toronto, where I live. And I've talked to some of her family, and she lived an incredible life. So I'm noodling with the idea of a novel about her life called The Emperor's Daughter. But we'll see if that comes to pass.
Oh, all right. Well, thank you so much, Hugh. I know that you are a Titanic expert, and it's really interesting to get these informational bits from you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Elaine. Great to talk to you.
All righty, bye.